When Alaskans talk about going outside, they typically mean any place beyond the state's border. But when those of us in the lower 48 want to get outside, and there's probably no better or definitely no bigger outside in the entire United States than Alaska. It might be one of those reasons we're called outsiders by the locals. One such local is Lisa Maloney. She's the author of The Moon Guide to Alaska, and she's lived in Anchorage now for over 30 years, and that's long enough to be considered an insider. Most visitors these days experience Alaska on a cruise ship, skimming the ports of its spectacular southeast panhandle, but barely touching the rest of the coastline or the vast interior. So what I want to do right now is spend a few minutes with Lisa Maloney, and I want to get beyond the cruise ports. For that, we're going to need Lisa's help. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've apparently fell in love with Alaska when your parents, I understand, dragged you there kicking and screaming as a kid. 30 years later, you're still there. What is it about Alaska?
This is true. I think it is the fact that when you leave an Alaska town, you're out of town. Capital O, capital O, capital T. You are now out of the city, and you can tell there are dozens or often hundreds of miles of trees or mountains between you and the next place. So the fact that even living in Alaska's biggest city as I do, I'm really only a short drive from true wilderness. You know, I wasn't born with a connection to that, but gosh, it sure got a hold of me once we moved up here, and I can't imagine being without it.
Well, you're not alone, because in your book you quote John Muir, and he said, you shouldn't go to Alaska because once you do, you'll never be satisfied with anywhere else for the rest of your life. Can you relate to that?
I can absolutely relate to that. I will say maybe it's a little different for other people, you know, depending on how much you prioritize being close to family and friends. It's actually a big deal. It can feel a little isolating up here. But for me, the wilderness and the real world, which is what I think of the natural world as, that's what wins out over everything else.
Well, yes, for sure, the real world. Now, most of us experience Alaska, as I mentioned, on a cruise ship. And that's, you know, a great way to travel if you want to just see the wonders from the deck of this big ship with 1,000 or 3,000 other people. I'm fascinated by the sort of the backstory of how the cruise industry works. I would imagine most of the cruise action is in the southeast. And the cruise ship has to negotiate with a town to dock there and to let its people out and buy stuff and everything. And some towns play ball with the cruise industry, and some towns decide not to. I suppose it's a mixed bag. If you're a Skagway, do you really want your economy dominated by the cruise industry? As an Alaskan resident, what do you think the pros and cons are for that a town has to discuss before they open the door to the cruise industry?
Sure. So just to be upfront, cruise ships very, very rarely stop in Anchorage. So I'm more relaying what I've heard and seen while visiting ports where there is a lot of cruise activity. The upside is getting a lot of bodies delivered straight to you. The downside, I think, is that those bodies don't always stay in town, or they might be funneled into activities, because when you're on a cruise ship, one of the most important things is not to miss the ship, right? So a lot of cruise passengers naturally gravitate toward activities that promise to get them back on time. Or if they take an excursion that is run by the cruise ship or in partnership with the cruise ship, and if you're late while on that excursion, the ship will actually wait for you. As opposed to if you go off on your own devices and maybe book an independent excursion, if there's a delay, let's say you're on a boat tour and the boat's engine dies out, then if you miss your boat, the boat's not going to wait for you because you weren't on their trip, not their business, and you'll have to catch up to them later. So because of that, I think it's pretty natural that cruise ship passengers tend to get funneled into these excursions that might actually be run by the cruise ship company, as opposed to the locals.
It's a big part of their profit. I mean, a lot of times you can marvel at how cheap a cruise is before you factor in how much you're going to spend on the excursions.
Right. So there's a question of how much, as a cruise passenger, how much of your money that you're spending seemingly locally, the big question there is how much of that is actually going into the local economy. Another thing that happens in some cruise ports, or I've seen it in quite a few of them up here, and I know it's a real bone of contention within the communities, is that once you're established as a big ship cruise port, then people start coming in from out of town or out of state or maybe even out of country and setting up during the summers, during the active cruise season, to run a shop selling things to visitors who come on the cruise ships, and then they leave at the end of the year. So again, that is more money that the visitors think they are spending locally and supporting local businesses, but that's not actually the effect.
We're exploring Alaska beyond the cruise ports right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Our guest is travel writer and hiking enthusiast Lisa Maloney. She writes The Moon Guide to Alaska, which has been her home for the last 30 years. Lisa is also the author of Day Hiking South Central Alaska and 50 Hikes Around Anchorage. Her website is hikingalaska.net, or you can find her on social media platforms under the handle @hikingalaska. We know that we can have it all on a platter when we take a cruise, and most people go to Alaska and enjoy that, and for most people it probably makes perfect sense. If you're a little more independent and you want to do Alaska without the cruise industry, it's fun to think of the regions and what they have to offer. In your book, you lay out 5 regions, 3 in the south, the far north, and then the interior, the Denali National Park, essentially. Let's talk about each of those regions. First of all, the most famous that we all would see if we took a cruise is Juneau in the southeast, right?
Absolutely. And I consider Juneau sort of the epicenter of that, in part because they do host an awful lot of cruise ships, but also because they're a very easy port to fly into. So if you wanted to see southeast Alaska, flying there by jet going to Juneau is one of the easiest ways to start your journey. Once you're there, you can still get around by boat, but it doesn't have to be a cruise ship. One of my favorite ways to explore southeast Alaska is on the Alaska State Ferry, which is technically known as the Alaska Marine Highway System. Kind of a cool little factoid. It is actually considered a federal highway simply because it provides such essential services and connections to a lot of communities that are on islands. So, you know, you can't drive there, and sometimes you can't even take a big plane to get there. So a boat is the best way to go.
And you can essentially camp out on that ferry and enjoy sort of a poor man's cruise.
You can literally camp out on the ferry. It is absolutely one of my favorite things to do. They have these solariums, or any of the ferries that take a journey of more than a few hours long usually have these. They are like an open air covered area on the top deck of the ship, but they have heat lamps. So even if it's a kind of a crisp day, you're usually not too cold. And if you're at the front of the line when you get on the ferry, you can kind of hustle up there. You have to beat the crowds because lots of other people want to do it too. Uh-huh. You take your sleeping bag and you get yourself either a patch of floor space or one of the plastic loungers that they have up there. And you can just camp.
The second region that you mention in your book, Lisa, is Anchorage and South Central. It's interesting to me, there's 3 regions along the south, and that is where the lion's share of the visitors go. So we just talked about Juneau in the southeast. Next would be Anchorage and South Central before we get to the big arm that sticks out with the Aleutian Islands and so on, right? So tell us a little bit about Anchorage and the South Central region.
Sure. So Anchorage is my home stomping grounds. I've lived here for more than 30 years. And I'd say one of the most remarkable things about it is that you can drive lots of places from here. The road system in Alaska does not cover the entire state. It's really focused here in South Central and then up into the interior around Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. So just the fact of having so many scenic drives makes South Central pretty special. We're also at the nexus of land and sea to a certain degree. So there are places where you can hop on a day cruise, for example, to go see tidewater glaciers calving into the ocean. And then you can also go for a wonderful hike. And again, more to the point, you can drive between those two things. You can drive between your day cruise port and wherever you're going for a hike.
And you could drive 4 hours or so to Denali National Park and see a mountain that's 5,000 feet taller than Mount Rainier.
You absolutely can. And actually, one of the most amazing things about Denali is that the best place to see it is not necessarily in Denali National Park, although you can get some amazing views there, but you can get some spectacular views from just 2 or 3 hours north of Anchorage, right off the road.
Nice. And by the way, for the old timers here who think about Mount McKinley, that's now called Denali out of respect to the Native Alaskans, right?
Yes. So I would say that locally it has always been known as Denali, but it is now recognized federally as Denali as well.
Ah, okay. Lisa Maloney is offering us an insider's guide to Alaska beyond the cruise ship ports right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She's a longtime resident of Anchorage, a hiking enthusiast and guide, and the author of the Moon Guidebook to Alaska. The next region I'd like you to explain a little bit is that southwest, what you call the arm with Kodiak.
So I would say starting from Kodiak, you know, I've never actually picked too many brains about whether Kodiak would be considered part of South Central or part of Southwest Alaska. But the fact that it is an island, and it just ties so well into that region, because you'll see a lot of similarities between, say, Kodiak and going on down the Aleutian Islands. These are all big fishing ports.
Yeah, Bristol Bay, I just think of like industrial strength, massive fishing, Bristol Bay.
Absolutely. And the Bering Sea that is, you know, you can't really see it, but I always joke that I carry a map of Alaska around on my arm with me. Because if you curl your bottom three fingers in and you leave your index finger sticking out and your thumb sticking out, and then you turn your hand so those two fingers are at the bottom, if you do it with your right hand...
I was doing it with my left hand, so now I got to arc it all the way around.
Okay, yeah. If you do it with your right hand or with your left hand, and imagine you're looking in a mirror, and if you're looking at the back of your hand, then that looks like a map of Alaska. And yeah. So the Aleutian Islands would be your index finger, that sort of long sweep of islands, and up above them is the Bering Sea. And that also is...
So my middle finger knuckle is Nome.
Just about, yeah. But so that whole sweep going down your index finger, or more appropriately, the Aleutian Islands, you have these relatively isolated and remote communities where fishing is usually a big part of the lifestyle. Kodiak fits in with that, absolutely. Crabbing is a huge industry in Kodiak and fishing in general. The Aleutians would be mostly treeless, and they would also be bearless, which is kind of exciting for people who might be concerned about having outdoor adventures in bear land. Kodiak, of course, does have bears. They have the largest subspecies of bear in the world, I believe, the Kodiak brown bear. But still, there's just a lot of similarities, so it makes sense to tie Kodiak in there.
And then the middle of your hand, going back to your hand map, would be the Denali National Park, which is a vast natural wonderland. But let's just finish off talking with the Arctic.
So, up at the very top of your hand, in the Arctic, we've done away with roads for the most part. So we're back to having to fly to most places. There might be river access between some communities, but those are not places that visitors would usually go. And one of the biggest communities to visit in the Arctic is Utqiagvik. And I'm just going to apologize if I'm not saying that perfectly, but I think I'm pretty close. Mm-hmm. Some listeners might be more used to hearing that described as Barrow, because that was the name, but the community voted to adopt a more traditional name for it, thus Utqiagvik. It is a remarkable place that you absolutely must visit at least once in your life just to see what life is like there, because it's very different than what you or I might expect in some ways.
Now, how so? Because in your book, you talk about deep indigenous traditions. Is that part of that, what you're talking about, so different?
Absolutely. So, for example, I have not had this experience myself because I've never been in town at exactly the right time, but I have spoken to people who've gone up there when whaling was happening, and they actually got to help pull a whale in. Because if a whaling crew actually catches a whale, it's all hands on deck,
it's
the entire
community.
It's big
news in the town formerly known as Barrow.
It's huge news, and it's also a huge animal, so people actually turn out to pull it in. So Utqiagvik is also one of the few places where you might be able to see polar bears, which I know is a big, exciting item for people. They are usually not wandering through town. It can happen, but the community actually goes to pains to make sure that doesn't happen as much as possible.
When you think of going way up into the north, where you've got this rich culture and this powerful natural opportunities, it involves flying. Local people fly around Alaska like we catch a bus, it seems like. Mm-hmm. What's it like for a tourist to fly around Alaska?
If you're going somewhere like Nome or Utqiagvik or even Kodiak, then you can actually fly there in a 737. So the experience is not going to be that different. But if you wanted a real Alaska experience, say, then you might hop into a mail plane that happens in a few places. We're talking postal mail, not male or female. Right. And those are small planes that can be anywhere from 1 to 8 passengers that bop around the smaller communities that you absolutely cannot reach by road. And that is how they get their mail. The plane flies up, drops it off, and then takes off again.
And if you're just talking in very, very general terms, would you say $100 per hop, whether you're going on a bigger plane or a little plane, or how much if you just want to fly from town to town in Alaska where there are no roads?
You know, these smaller planes are, interestingly enough, much more expensive than the bigger planes. And at the same time, if you are flying in a bigger plane, say a 737 around Alaska, that tends to be more expensive than a longer flight down to Seattle.
Oh, really?
For
so
example.
It's quite costly to hop from town to town then. You'd be, if you're on a budget, you'd be better off going in and around Anchorage with a tour or with a train or with a car.
It's much easier, yes. And accommodations tend to be more expensive in the smaller communities, too. One thing that might be important for visitors to keep in mind also is that in the very, very small communities, sometimes there isn't a single hotel and there are really no visitor accommodations. So those are the types of places that you wouldn't go unless you're invited, simply because there's not going to be anywhere for you to sleep unless you're sleeping on a, you know, the gymnasium floor in the school. But you'd have to, you don't just drop in and say, hi, can I sleep in your gym? They need to invite you in to do that.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Lisa Maloney. She writes The Moon Guidebook to Alaska. So Lisa, you know, we've been talking about enjoying Alaska beyond the cruise ships. If you had a friend who's going to Alaska and they want to experience it beyond the cruise ships, what's your best single piece of advice?
To accept that you probably will not be able to see the entire state. So instead, just because of the sheer size of it and the logistical challenge sometimes of getting from one place to the other, instead of trying to see the entire state and then feeling sort of sad and disappointed that you spent all your time running around and no time actually seeing anything, pick a region that appeals to you. Pick maybe 2 or 3 of the activities or experiences that you most want to have, then dial in which region is going to give you the best chance of doing those things, and plan to spend some time there. If you have more than, say, 2 weeks, then pick a second region and go there too. But you can really occupy yourself for a week or two in one single region and still feel like you've only scratched the surface.
Nice. Lisa Maloney, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes with your work, sharing your expertise on Alaska with all the people who dream of visiting.
Thank you so much, Rick. It was a pleasure to be here.
Lisa Maloney tells us about the thrills of getting outdoors into the Alaska winter in a Travel with Rick Steves interview from December 2023. You can hear it from our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. A creative writing professor from Texas takes us along on his summer hike in Iceland into an environment that, apart from lots of open space, is the polar opposite from his home in Lubbock. That's next.